Greetings to the crew of the Gaian Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. Your navigator, John Lash, here, recording on the 3rd of July, 2013. This is installment 3 of Nav Briefing 73, and the title is The Company of the Grail. To pick up where I left off, in the last talk, let me just run down the list of main characters in the Grail legend, as recorded by Wolfram von Eschenbach and others. As you may know, there are probably a dozen well-known and much-studied versions of the Grail legend from the medieval period. I choose to rely exclusively on the version of Wolfram von Eschenbach, written in Middle High German and completed around the year 1210, I believe, between 1210 and 1220. I do so because that version is not only a spectacular piece of literature, a masterpiece, not only contains vivid and elaborate detail and authentic references to the life of the times, but also because it is truer to the pre-Christian, non-Christian, and pagan version of the Grail legend. And that is the one, that is the version to draw upon today in order to return to those roots and to restore that story into the form of a living inspiration for the world today. So principally, of course, we have Parzival, who is the main character, he who comes to attain the Grail. But let's consider the circumstances of Parzival's quest. First of all, there is a kind of backstory, as they say, in the film business. And the backstory of Parzival actually occupies the opening chapters of Wolfram's version. If you want to review this material, go to metahistory.org, click on Alternative Grail, and scroll down until you find the synopsis of Parzival. There you will have a chapter-by-chapter synopsis of the events of the narrative, okay? But right now, I'm just going to concentrate on the backstory, the events that occurred before the quest begins. Parzival's father was a knight named Gahmuret, G-A-H-M-U-R-E-T, Gahmuret. And while he was connected with Herzeleide, who is Parzival's mother, he was not principally or exclusively connected with one woman. He was something of a womanizer, as many of the Arthurian knights were known to be. So from his union with Herzeleide, Gahmuret had a son, Parzival, but Gahmuret died during the 9-month period before Parzival was born. So Parzival is the son of the widow, and the widow is Herzeleide. And that occurred in Wales, because she was a princess of Wales. That story, the historical incidents and real persons reflecting that legend took place in Wales. Now, Gahmuret also wandered far to the east, to the realm of the Tigris and Euphrates, what we would today call Syria and Iran, or Syria and Iraq, excuse me, and had a number of adventures there. And during those adventures, he had a love affair with an Arabian princess named Belkane. And so from the union of Gahmuret and Belkane came another son, Firfiz. And actually, this odd name, Fierfiz, F-I-E-R-F-I-Z, derives from the French fier, meaning proud, and fils, F-I-L-S, meaning son. So Fierfiz is the proud son, that is to say, the first son of the wandering knight Gamaret, or Gamaret. Therefore, the older son, and his mother is Belcaine. The half-brother to Fierfiz is Parzival, and his mother is Hertzelady. Now, that's the backstory. And as we come forward in the legend, toward the end of the legend, toward the final chapters of Wolfram's version, what comes to light is the further development of the so-called family constellation of the Grail. So when you scroll down to the final sections of my synopsis on medhistory.org, you will find the following. Parzival himself, although shy of women and somewhat awkward and certainly unskilled in the arts of love and flirtation, nevertheless did undergo a number of adventures with women. But among them, one stood out above all the others, and this was his true love, Conduira Murs. It's a funny name, it's an interesting name, C-O-N-D-W-I-R-A-M-U-R-S. The word Murs at the end relates to the French meurs, which means morals or behavior. And the prefix conduire is like the verb conduire, meaning to drive, to conduire une voiture, to drive a car. So it really, but in the middle of conduire and meurs, the word amour kind of squeezes in because it's conduire amours. And that name means love that guides morals, or lovely morals, lovely behavior. And so, obviously, it is a title of high nobility, of beauty, of elegance, indicating the character of the woman whom Parzival loved the most and above all others. She was the wife of Parzival as well, and they had a son named Lohengrin. Now, what happens at the end of Wolfram's version, which is indicated quite thoroughly in the details he gives, and less thoroughly and more episodically in other versions of the Grail legend? What happens is that Parzival attains the Grail, that is to say, that he rediscovers and claims the capacity of the teleste to access the organic light. If you attain the Grail, as Parzival did, you do it in the same way he did. Everyone does it in the same way. And it is the same experience for everyone. The encounter with the organic light is the attainment of the Grail, and it is the same for everyone. So Parzival attained this, but then he immediately transferred or passed on that capacity to the future. And this act is called the transmission of the Grail. Now, Wolfram gives some interesting particulars regarding how this transmission took place. And he specifies that it occurred in two ways, or along two lines, you could say. The story says that the Grail dish, which is what it is in Wolfram, it's a dish or a platter, it's not a chalice, that the Grail dish, the actual article, because, again, according to the rule of Idris, the story is written in observation of a literal and symbolic truth at the same time. That article was in the hands of Parsifal, came into the hands of Parsifal from those who had been holding it and preserving it. We'll get to who they were in a moment. And he immediately turned around and passed it on to his half-brother, Phaerphis. Now there's a whole another tapestry of narrative events connected with that single detail. And it's quite a perspective when you start to look into it. It's quite an intriguing scenario that unfolds in this act of transmission or handover, which is the first part of the transmission of the Grail, which you could say it's the literal part. So the story goes that Phaerphis, who let's remember is half Iranian or Persian and half French probably, takes it to the Far East. He takes the Grail to the Far East and he takes it to the kingdom of Prester John. Now, who the heck is Prester John? Well, this is a really fascinating chapter in medieval history. There's a great deal of argument about whether Prester John actually existed or not, whether it was merely a legendary person. It might have been an historical person, and of course, as you now well know, it was that identity was a mixture of actual historical elements and purely legendary or fictional elements. Whatever you might make of Prester John, and go research it just a little bit, 15 minutes will give you the picture. There is no doubt of where the trail goes from Parsifal by way of his half-brother. The trail goes to the Himalayas and to the kingdom of Shambhala. And here is a direct link between the diaspora of the mysteries and the Grail itself, which is the central experience of the mysteries, and Tibet, Shambhala, Tantrayana, Tibetan Buddhism, and all that jazz. And I can assure you that this connection, which I call the Vajrayana romance, is rich, strong, and verifiable through historical and literary and cultural evidence, and that it was carried forward in time from the 13th century into the Romantic movement of the 19th century, and that it thrived. The Vajrayana romance connecting the Gnostic mysteries with Tibetan Buddhism has been up and running for hundreds of years. I'd also point out, and I think I've written about this, you know, I don't know, because I can't remember. I remember less and less about what I've written. The more I talk, the less I remember about what I wrote. This is getting to be a serious situation here. But I probably did somewhere on metahistory.org raise the claim, and this is a claim exclusive to yours truly, the main Turton, that the wish-fulfilling gem, as it is called, the wish-fulfilling gem, the Chintamani, the gem of Om Mani Padme Hum, that gem in Tibetan Buddhism is actually the Grail of the pagan mysteries. That is the form in which it is recognized and described in that other culture and in the Himalayan setting to which the Grail was brought by the half-brother of Parsifal. The wish-fulfilling gem. Go look it up. Or especially if you ever get a chance to read The Life and Teachings of Naropa by H.V. Gunther, you'll find a great deal of commentary about the wish-fulfilling gem in that book. Okay, back to the Grail Castle. There is Parsifal with his wife, the love of his life, Conduira Murs, and there is their son, Lohengrin. And it is presumed, we might presume, that some kind of transmission occurs from father to son. Now, not necessarily, because one thing that I pointed out in my book, The Hero, Manhood in Power, is that paternity does not apply to the heroic lineage. That's one of the reasons why Parsifal has to be the son of a widow. He has to be uprooted from paternity and from patriarchal influence, a boy without a father. And given that condition is so important in the Grail quest, we may wonder about the relation between Parsifal and his son, Lohengrin. Just by being the son of Parsifal doesn't guarantee anything. There can be, and there is not, in the mysteries, then or now, any guarantee of transmission through familial lines. Most of the members of the mystery cells were not related to each other on familial terms. And by far, the great majority of the young entrants and neophytes in the mystery cells, some of whom were adopted early on by the Gnostic teachers in their role of instructors and mentors, were children whose parents had nothing to do with their spiritual education. So the Gnostics were against procreation, yet they took responsibility for raising and educating the children of others. Why? Because they were dedicated to the divine potential of humanity and not to the biological and blood-based connections. The divine potential of humanity is not principally carried in blood-based connections. It is blood-based, but not relating to familial connections. Every human animal carries in his or her blood the inheritance of the entire human species, not just the selected genetic factors deriving from a family line. So given all these considerations, which most of which you know already, I'm sure, we have to say, well, we can't presume anything. We can't presume that there was a transmission through Lohengrin. At least, well, there wouldn't be enough evidence for that in Wolfram and in other French language versions of the Grail legend. But would there be evidence for it somewhere else? Well, indeed, there is. You recall that I mentioned one of the people I knew in the Belgian nobility was the Princess of Merod. Her name was Philippine. And she actually lived a few miles away from a small village in southern Belgium where I lived in the early 1990s. So I became friends with Philippine, and I also served in the role of her tutor and astrologer over a couple of years. And I talked a lot to Philippine about the Grail, and I was surprised to find out that she didn't know anything about it. I mean, she, of course, thought that it was isn't that the chalice? The chalice, you know, this relic of Christianity. And it goes to show you the power of a narrative, the power of storytelling. This is a story that she'd been told, and generations of people in her family had been told that. So gradually I wore away this concept to sort of open her mind to a broader understanding of what the Grail was, although what I could do was rather limited in those circumstances. But I decided at that time to do a little project with the princess. So I produced a little book. I don't have a copy of it anymore. It was just so we published it. She actually had it printed up and copied and spiral bound and handed it out to 100 or so members of the Belgian nobility. And this was basically just a story about the Grail, recounting, however, the Christian version. I could only push it so far at that time. I just recounted the version and cited the sources relative to the legend that Joseph of Arimathea collected the blood of Christ in a chalice that had been used at the Last Supper, and then he brought this chalice to England, and then this chalice was la relique, ou le relique, I can't remember. It was the relic. And I went through the history of that because I found out that although I expected these people in the Belgian nobility to know something about the legendary background of what nobility is, I was wrong. They didn't have the faintest idea what the legendary background of their own deeply revered and carefully preserved family traditions was about. They had no conception that the medieval construct, if you will, of the, quote, Grail family, unquote, was really the source of the mystique of nobility. You know, these noble lines trace themselves back numbers of centuries. Actually, most of them have fictionalized their own history. They've retrospectively created their own history. Most of them are not that old. In fact, the very idea of nobility in which they are steeped and in which they invest their identity and the identity of their children is a fairly recent development in Western history, certainly a post-Renaissance development. So anyway, to make a long story short, I put together this story of the Grail based on the version of Robert de Boron. And Robert de Boron was a French Grail storyteller who was the first to graft the Celtic Grail legend onto Christianity, and the first to associate literally the Grail with that chalice. And I've actually seen the vellum manuscript. I have actually seen and touched the vellum manuscript of Robert de Boron, in which this nefarious deed of narrative deceit was achieved. It's in the possession of the Rietman Special Library of Medieval Manuscripts in Amsterdam at the Bibliothek Hermetica on the Blumengracht. So it's remarkable that I have been this close to the sources, both the sources of deceit and the sources of the authentic and viable truth of the Grail legend. It's something that my destiny has provided for me over many years. Now, as I said, I wasn't terribly satisfied with peddling a Christian version of the Grail legend to these people, but I couldn't do any better in those circumstances. At the same time, you have to realize that this was in 1991 or 1992, and it was a good 10 years before the moment when I would find myself in Arc, France, in May of 2000. The moment when I achieved a steady contemplation of the organic light in recognition that it was the organic light. So you could say I attained the Grail in Arc, France, in May 2000. But 8 or 9 years earlier, I was deeply involved in trying to transmit the legend of the Grail, not the encounter with the organic light, of course, but simply the legend of the Grail I was trying to transmit that to these people. And so I pulled off a little trick. After all, Philippine was a Belgian princess, and although some of the people came over from Paris, were members of the French nobility for my talk that I gave, thanks to another Belgian family. Most of the people who received this extraordinary information were Belgians, so I did the same thing that Wolfram did. When he went around telling his story at various castles, because the Grail storytelling genre was a gig, you know, it was a gig, and the storytellers of the Grail and many other folk tales of the medieval period earned their living, and they earned the circumstances of their bread and board by reciting the stories in the salons and halls of the rich and privileged people of the time. Just exactly what I was doing, right? So I played, a Parsifal lamb in Wolfram's clothing. And I said, well, a way to get the attention of these people is to flatter their ego and their sense of entitlement and prestige. And the way to do that is to pick up the Lohengrin story, because lo and behold, the Lohengrin story has a follow-up in Belgium. There is a legend. I can't cite the sources of this right now. As I say, my memory is sketchy and I haven't looked into these materials for a long time. But there is a legend that connects Lohengrin intimately with Belgium, which was called Lothringia at the time of the events of the 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries. And the story goes that there was a woman living in Anvers, that is the northern part of Belgium by the sea. It's a port, the port of Anvers. And that she was the daughter, get this, oh, you're going to love this. She was the daughter or the cousin or the close relation, it's all the same to these people, of a dynastic union between a Princess Alise and the Duke Lambikin. And this dynasty of Duke Lambikin was located in the provinces of Belgium known as Hainaut and Brabant. And that is exactly where I was living. That's where Philippine was living. We were living in the place where these events supposedly took place, and certainly some events did really happen here that reflect the legend which survives. And here is the Princess of Mérode living in the middle of this medieval legend and doesn't even know it. So I thought, well, I can really charm these people by putting them into the story, by connecting them to it, which is exactly what Wolfram used to do. That was the trick of the storyteller. And when he would go and recite part of the Grail legend to a number of people in the court over a period of evenings, he would cleverly weave into the story references to cousin this and king that and the person over in the next domain so that they felt that they were included in the story and they were flattered to be so. So this is what I did with these Belgian folks. And if you go to the alternative history of the Grail and click on the second part, the enlightenment of the Swan Knight, Lohengrin and the passing of the Grail, well, you'll find more detail on the story that I told them. The second part of this little booklet that the princess kindly distributed for me was the story of a Belgian woman of the nobility whose name was Elsa. Elsa of Brabant. And that woman, to which I just referred, was connected with the dynasty of the Duke of Lambikin in the area of Hainaut and Brabant. And so I'll pick up now the thread of the Lohengrin legend from the text that I cited. Wolfram says that Lohengrin, Parzival's son with Conwyramur's, grew into a strong and valiant man who mastered the arts of chivalry. At some point, he heard of the plight of a noble lady of the lowlands, Elsa of Brabant. She refused all suitors, much to the frustration of many men, the barons of the region. Elsa provoked intense male animosity by her independent stance. She was just plain unavailable to be an accessory to the male rule of order. Finally, one of the barons attempted to force her hand and make her enter into marriage against her will. But this was not to be. While he was living in a castle in Alsace, that would be the Königsberg Castle, over in Germany, nearby, Lohengrin heard a magical call, a high-pitched ringing like a distant bell. It drew him toward the lowlands. Upon entering Flanders, he found the source of the Dendre, a small river that feeds into the Schelde. Riding on a light skiff pulled by a swan, he went up the Schelde to Anvers, or Antwerp, the Flemish port on the North Sea. There he discovered the plight of Elsa, and he intervened, defeating the aggressive baron in a jousting match. After rejecting all of the men, Elsa accepted Lohengrin because she loved him for his character. He was handsome, courtly, perspicacious, tactful, courageous, and generous. A true gentleman of the chivalric tradition, such as she had never seen before. In short, Lohengrin was a true hero, a man appreciative of the feminine, aligned to the goddess, and not a patriarchal champion bent on overthrowing the goddess and defeating the ethical code and system of values she inspires. The distinction between hero and champion is central to my book, The Hero. Now, Elsa and Lohengrin, known as the Prince of Brabant, lived a wonderful life, looking after the concerns of the common people. But Lohengrin had to tell her about the conditions of his service. Namely, that no one, including herself, could ask about his family name or his origin. "If I am subject to questioning, you will have lost my love," he warned her. She gave her pledge, but through her very affection for him, she would later betray it. The more good the prince did, the more the people wished to acknowledge him, but to do so, they asked about his name and family origins. This was natural for them to do because social custom dictated that prestige goes to the families who serve the existing order and work for the betterment of society. At least that is a way to conceive the noble ideal. Elsa herself was attached to this custom and wanted her husband to receive due credit for his good works. But the writing on the Grail flatly stated a condition that precluded the accrual of social prestige for the work of bettering society. Curiously, the observance of this condition fell on society rather than on the one who served it. The question of family origins must not be asked. That is to say, it must not be given importance. Lohengrin could not violate this condition by disclosing his origins as the son of Parzival, but the mere act of asking him about them could and did rupture the situation. This is what happened eventually when Elsa succumbed to social pressure and asked the prince about himself. At that moment, the mysterious swan came back, and Lohengrin climbed aboard the skiff with his sword, shield, and helmet. He is said to have fallen into a trance, or fallen asleep, on his shield, as the swan pulled the skiff away across the sullen gray waters of the North Sea. End quote. So you can read that piece and the relating material at length in the chapters of the Alternative History of the Grail on metahistory.org. Now, I know there's a lot of European lore here, and this is not a cowboy story, although I've converted the whole Grail legend of Wolfram into a cowboy story for my American friends and lovers of the land of the free and the home of the brave. And so not to saturate you too much with European folklore, but I just ask you to look at this story as a story. I ask you to consider the plot of the story and what an interesting twist it has in it. Remember that one of the motifs of the Grail quest, one of the three conditions of attaining the Grail, is that Parzival must not be cued or coached regarding the question that he must ask. He must ask a question of the Wounded Grail King, but no one can tell him what question to ask, nor can they even tell him that he needs to ask a question. This is a key and unique element in the Grail legend. Now turn it around, and it's as if in the Lohengrin sequence, you know, the sequel to the Grail legend, as it were, you're seeing a similar play on the motif of asking the question. But in this case, the rule is, sorry, ma'am, no questions, please. I can only fulfill my role as a noble and overprivileged person who serves the community if you don't give any importance to my lineage and my name. Well, I see that condition as a rule that could be applied to those of the members of those European families who call themselves nobility and who are not merely parasites and narcissists of high entitlement, but would actually like to do something for the world and actually like to use their power and privilege and largesse for the benefit of humanity. Well, that's how naive I was when I developed and presented this material to these people. Needless to say, the reception was a flop. They do not have the slightest interest in doing anything of the sort with their power and wealth. At least I never encountered anyone who did, and I met a lot of them. So, what does the legend of Lohengrin tell us? Well, it suggests this to me. It suggests that Wolfram, because it appears that these details I'm citing are in Wolfram. I didn't think they were. Okay. Must be in the last chapter. That Wolfram, cynically perhaps, but also realistically, looked forward in time and he saw that the privilege of being in the Grail family or the company of the Grail would fall to people who were materialistic, and therefore it would not survive. And it didn't survive. And that is why the story of Lohengrin ends the way it does. And I am pretty convinced now, having mulled over this narrative a good many times, that the story of Lohengrin represents the failure of the European nobility to recognize and own and claim their own spiritual origins and to accept that they have a spiritual and transpersonal mission by association with the Grail. And so if there were a transmission, as I suggested in writing that piece, somewhat hopefully, forgive me, please, if there were indeed a transmission through Lohengrin, then it was a transmission that failed. We want to look at failures. Failures are very instructive. The failures in your life, every failure that I've made, every error that I've made, has taught me 10 times more than my successes. So I'm recounting this legend of Lohengrin in association with the Parzival legend to bring us to the central topic of the company of the Grail. And as I'm doing so, I'm continuing my travelogue, obviously. When I come here to Belgium, I enter a space, a territory, a country, a land that is absolutely and totally saturated with memories for me. And some of these memories are transpersonal and transgenerational, and they waft around me like vapors. And the granular detail of the coincidences between my stumblebung travels with no money hanging around in the chateaus and palaces of the dregs of the European nobility, my misguided and stumblebum adventures nevertheless reveal a granular detail of fate working out its cosmic designs in human affairs. The legend says that Lohengrin sailed in his boat. He arrived at Anvers, sailing up the river. And the main river that goes to Anvers has a tributary that feeds into it called the Dendre, D-E-N-D-R-E. Well, when I got to Belgium in 1991, right after the Secrets Handbook came out, about 6 months afterwards, I didn't initially live there. My friend at the time had some connections with the Belgian nobility, particularly one friend who is still a friend of mine, I would say, whom the European that I have known for the longest period of time, a count. And when my partner and I at that time came back from living in Greece for the winter on the Isle of Idra, we were stranded in the summer of 1992 in Brussels, and we had no place to live for the coming fall and winter. And my friend the Count, the Comte du Brie, who claims to descend from Geoffrey de Bouillon, who was a major crusader, kindly arranged with his friends for us to stay on the grounds of an ancestral domain in the southern part of Belgium in a tiny little village called Lombise. Now, in this village of Lombise, L-O-M-B-I-S-E, there's a beautifully preserved chateau. It has a moat around it. It has gardens, fields. It has deer, a deer park and a moat. And not too far from the main chateau itself is a pavillon de chasse, they call it. It's actually a large house where the owners of the chateau, of the family of Boissier-Thien, received their guests. And we got the guest house for the winter. It saved our lives. We lived there free. We had to because we didn't have any money. And while I was living there in Lombise, I met the Princess of Marad, who lived about 5 miles away. The only people I met were people in the Belgian nobility. For the first 3 years that I lived in Europe, first 4 years, the only people I knew were people in the Belgian and French and German nobility. I didn't meet one ordinary person. Apart from the time that Joanna and I were living on Idra in Greece, on the Isle of Idra, I did not know one single ordinary person. And so there I was in the guest house beside this Disney-esque chateau with its deer park and its moat. And I used to take walks around in the countryside. And I kept returning to a particular place that was not far from the grounds of the chateau. In fact, I think it was on the grounds of the chateau. It was a little brook where fishermen would sometimes go, those who were allowed on the grounds. And I investigated it later, and guess what? That brook turned out to be the source of the Dendre. We talk about getting to the source. And this, again, is an example that does not make me a rare and outstanding person. This is fate. Fate operates in granular detail. The mills of the gods grind slow, but they grind exceeding fine. And when you meet your fate, you meet it in the granular detail of people, places, and things. But that granular detail has the property of reflecting and refracting into far dimensions of the cosmos. So there is a cosmic pattern to your life. There is a pattern that the aeons themselves behold and maintain by their loving gaze upon you. And the way that you know it is to encounter it in granular detail. So that capacity comes through loving your fate. Remember, the fate is what you cannot change except by love itself and by friendship. What I understand now from the teachings of Idris that unfold in a gentle and supporting, encouraging way during the shift is that fate can be changed in two ways. It can be changed internally by love, because love transforms the one who loves. And it can be changed externally by friendship. The fate of friendships disposes any change of fate. It's instruction of Idris. And so it was by friendship that I arrived at Belgium. And it was by the long-standing friendship that my partner of that time, Joanna, had with the Comte de Brie, and of the friendship that he had with the other members of his circle, because they don't have friends with anybody outside those circles. You can be sure of that. It was due to that pattern of friendships and those combined personal and familial destinies that I was led into the pattern of my own destiny here in this country, in Belgium. So, as I get to the last half hour of this briefing, let me concentrate on this phrase, the company of the Grail. There are two key phrases in the Grail legend, or a number of key phrases, and these are what are called motifs, or leitmotifs. Now, I was just listening to a little bit of Wagner's opening of Parzival, and Wagner was known to have used in his music a device which is called the leitmotif. So you have these vast orchestral compositions, and then you have the return in the source, in the course of the drama, in the course of the opera, you have the return and replay of a musical motif, which is a leitmotif of the narrative. So for instance, obviously in Wagner's Parzival, one of the leitmotifs is meeting the Grail. So every time that the story told in the opera comes around to a moment when Parzival is moving toward the Grail, or the moment when he encounters it, the orchestral composition presents the leitmotif for that moment. Likewise, in Tristan and Isolde, there is the leitmotif of the love-death theme. So it begins, it is introduced early in the composition of Tristan and Isolde by Wagner, Wagner's Tristan. And then at the moment, the culminating moment when Tristan and Isolde die, you have the full orchestral elaboration of the leitmotif. Okay? So, there are various leitmotifs in the Grail legend. The quest for the Grail, the appearance of Kundry, the lovely damsel, the encounter between Parzival and Trevisant, who recounts to him the story of his own background, the transmission of the Grail, and the company of the Grail, or what is called the Grail family. And finally, there is the motif of the wasteland. In French, la terre gaste, G-A-S-T-E. La terre gaste is the French word for the wasteland. I don't know what the German word is. Gâcher in French today means to ruin or waste. So la terre gaste is the wasteland. That's another theme. In the traditional story that comes down to us, the Grail family lives in the wasteland. They live in the middle of a devastated world where nature is in ruin and there is pollution and corruption everywhere and plants do not grow. And the water is polluted, or the waters of the rivers and lakes are putrid, or they are still. And yet the Grail family, representing the last remaining survivors of the diaspora of the mysteries, who hold the secret of the healing and regeneration of the human species, live isolated in this wasteland. And they cannot share or impart what they have with the world at large. That's the problem in the story of Parsifal. And that problem is solved when the young knight comes and attains the Grail and then turns to transmit it, that is to say, to release it back toward the world. This is the story. This is the greatest secular guiding narrative of Western civilization, bar none. Joseph Campbell said that. I didn't. He was absolutely right. And you can enrich and deepen your understanding of what I'm saying here by reading Creative Mythology, the last volume in his four volumes of The Masks of God. So at this point, let's apply the method of Idris in looking at this narrative. Let's take the motif of the company of the Grail and consider what it was, literally, and what it is in a higher dimension of meaning, what it is in the emergent moment of the life of the earth itself, and how you can place yourself in that moment. Traditionally speaking, of course, the company of the Grail was the Grail family. And the Grail family was a number of noble families who lived in medieval Europe before the current definition of nobility actually applied. They were really noble families, let's say. Let's say they were really, really noble families. Well, what would have made them noble? Well, guess. You know, the word nobility derives from the same Indo-European root to G-N-O for gnosis. So if there had been, really, if there existed in France, in Germany, in Lotharingia, and even in Spain, in Alsace-Lorraine, in Switzerland, if there existed in these lands in the medieval period any truly noble families, who would those people have been? They would have been those who held the company of the Grail. They would have been families who received and protected the diaspora of the mysteries. The people in the families themselves were not necessarily initiates of the organic light, but they would have had among their midst such initiates who would have been regarded as great teachers and as noble and elevated and illumined human beings, noble persons, and thereby the family who protected and surrounded them would have been noble. But the situation of that time, especially the 12th century, with the Fourth Lateran Council, of which Joseph Campbell speaks quite vividly. The situation of that time, with the power of the Roman Catholic Church, even though it was splitting with the Avignon papacy, and even though there was a lot of corruption and murder and infighting in the church, the different factions of the church were all united around the desire to absolutely annihilate the last Gnostic from the face of the planet. That is why the Grail families, and there were more than one, there were Grail castles in Alsace, Königsberg, here in Belgium, many in France, in Brittany, in Spain, in Jaén, on the southern side of the Pyrenees. There were Grail castles all over Europe. But those people in those privileged locales could not let the world at large know what they had, or else it would have been destroyed. Can you see now? Can you see that story now? Can you see the real and desperate circumstances of this legend? Now, the company of the Grail today is not what it was then. The company of the Grail today are those who come into planetary tantra by recognition of the Sophianic narrative, which is a planetary guiding myth, and within that narrative, the subset of the Grail legend. And to be in planetary tantra and know what the Grail is to be of the company of the Grail today. It's as simple as that. Now, you can know what the Grail is and be inspired and encouraged by that knowledge to transform your life, to transform what you do, without having had the direct encounter with the organic light. Just the knowledge of what the organic light is already a sublime privilege. Do you realize that? And then to be able to access it and ask it questions, as Parzival did and as the telestic shamans of the mysteries did, well, that is an extension of that privilege that may or may come in our time. And believe me, my friends, I am looking very closely at how to extend that privilege. So, I'm sure you're doing the same. And it's a mycelium event. So, the fruiting bodies of mushrooms can pop up anywhere in a field. Down at the far end of the field, or over here, or here by the road. But they all pop up out of the same hidden mycelium. So, the places where that privilege can be, as it were, fulfilled, could be anywhere that the company of the Grail resides, following the manner and circumstances in which they can make that possible. And this is the portal, this experience, this regathering of the company of the Grail is the portal toward the healing and regeneration of humanity, not to save Anthropos 10, but to ensure the emergence of Anthropos 11. Let's be clear on that. You know, I made a remark in a previous briefing that I really need to clarify and reiterate. I said that, remember the generic title of these talks is Where the Nightmare Ends, okay? Well, I said that the fact that the Aeon Sophia will manifest herself in a tulpa and become present not only in your lucid dreaming and in the nightmare of history, but to become present in the atmosphere as an active agent of her aeonic powers doesn't guarantee that the nightmare is going to end. It just means that she is physically, palpably, actively, concretely present in the nightmare. Bear that in mind. So I can't say when the nightmare ends, only she can determine that. But I can tell you where it ends. It ends wherever the company of the Grail meet, and where two or three of them together recognize each other and talk about their privilege and consider how to extend that privilege into the wasteland. And this is our topic. And this is a topic for the rest of your life if you want it. You're welcome to it. It's my topic and I live it every day. It will never be a matter of quantity. It doesn't have to be, because the power of the mythic narrative of the Aeon Savaya propagates itself fractally. You cannot have part of the solution for humanity. You can only have the whole solution and know your part in it. So it's my intention that at the conclusion of this briefing, even those of you who are not particularly fond of Europe or European folklore and who don't find your identity in that direction, and you may even be Oriental, I don't know, that's another subject I'm getting close to soon, or you may be American or South American, but as a human being, you really need to consider that this legend is the amber thread in our history. It is the amber thread that leads out of the nightmare. It is the thread of amber gain. What is amber gain? It is the place where the nightmare ends. And it can be any place. It doesn't happen to be or have to be exclusively in the Reed Valley of Andalusia. It's the place where amber gains, the place where amber increases. In the presence of the organic light, the living mother of the planet, the wisdom goddess, blushes amber when she recognizes her magical children doing what she designed them to do. She blushes amber in her naked light. And that is a fact. That is a verifiable fact. The nightmare ends where amber gains. So what else can I say in concluding this talk? I certainly am deeply moved and continue to be moved to be here in the tonal point of my personal reality, to coin a quaint phrase. And I have to say that I'm being as careful as I can in a number of ways. I'm quite aware that what I talk about is delicate and overwhelming at the same time. I really want to reassure you that the patterns of fate in your life that operate in granular detail have always been known to you. They've always been revealing themselves to you all through your life. What's difficult, my friends, is to pull those glimpses of the patterns together into a coherent weave and follow the weave. That's also a definition of Tantra. That's difficult. So I do not differ from any of you in any way regarding the granular revelations of my fate. No, not in the least. You are just exactly like me. The only way I may differ in some circumstances is in my capacity to detect that granularity and to render it into a coherent and enduring pattern. That's all. But that capacity also, the ability to do that, also comes from one single and self-same activity, from one single and self-same position that you take toward life. And that is what Nietzsche called amor fati. To love your fate, which is that which you cannot change. Remember again the Serenity Prayer adapted for our purposes. Goddess, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And isn't it remarkable that the word wisdom, Sophia, occurs in the 12-step movement, Serenity Prayer? And so every time that I say that fate cannot be changed, it's the Nawal ticking and tricking your attention. Because I say that it can't be changed, and you must love what you cannot change, but I also say that it can be changed, don't I? I say both. And it is both. Your fate can be changed by love, by powerful experiences of love, and by self-love. And the more you love your fate, which cannot seemingly be changed, the stronger and clearer becomes your capacity to detect its granular beauty. And then, given the circumstances of life, given the way things flow together, people, places, and things, circumstances, situations that come and go like the seasons, given all that, it's the friendship you have, the friendships you've lost, the friendships yet to come that dispose to any change of your fate. We are entering such a moment now. I feel like a tuning fork that has been struck by something very powerful. We are entering such a moment now that is the moment of I don't know what. It's the moment within the Gnostic moment. What is the moment within the Gnostic moment? It's Sunday, July 6th. That's the moment of an apogee surge in 2 degrees of Cancer at the feet of the twins in the perihelion of Saturn, remember? And at that moment, Jupiter itself stands at the point of surge. So this is the moment when the goddess herself strikes the tuning fork to bring the attention of humanity to her presence and to the company of those who hold her presence on this planet. And I have to say that as the days tick off right now, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, got a little more than 3 days, I feel like I'm a surfer, you know, paddling on my surfboard. You know how they do out there, those big waves they have in Hawaii, you know. And the wave is building and I'm paddling on my surfboard, calmly and steadily, not paddling wildly, paddling on my surfboard to get to the crest of that wave that's going to break. Because I want to be in the curl when this thing breaks. And I can tell you that as far as the Nahual sees, as far as a Gaian shaman like myself can detect right now, that the moment when the Aeon Sophia coordinates her first attention with her second attention in a monumental synthesis is in 3 days. And I have absolutely no idea what may come from that event. But I am certain that the consequences can be momentous. Really, I really am. I don't like to hype things or build things up. I don't like to get too dramatic. And of course, although we work with expectations, I don't like to build up big expectations that are then going to fail. But I can't help but say that for me, as a Gayan Tantrika, I have never anticipated a moment like this when the first and second attentions of the Aeon Sophia converge. That is the moment within the Gnostic moment to be lived into now, right now as I speak, and in the days to come. And in the future, some weeks or months or years after this moment has transpired, I am certain that people will talk about this moment and they will look back at us, the company of the Grail, holding the amber thread, holding her presence in our hearts and minds, indeed in our bodies. They will look back on us and they will know, someone in the future will know, that we will have been at the center of this wave. That we will have been transported in that power of her all-configurating beauty.